Okay, so I'd like to thank Alan for a very nice introduction to some of the questions in immunology. And my background's in immunology rather than in physics or mathematics, so that I guess that's the angle that I come at it at. And what I'd like to talk to you today is some attempts we've been making to understand the clonal evolution of the T cell response. And I'll first say a little bit about what we mean by that. So what Alan was saying about the very low frequency of cells that are able to recognize any particular virus, for example. So if we think of the number of cells able to respond to a virus over time, we'd start off very, very low before we're infected. Once we become infected, we get this clonal expansion. So the cells that recognize the virus proliferate very, very rapidly. We get a very high number, and ideally we eliminate the virus, and then those cells die off to some low level that persist for quite a long time, perhaps for life. But if we get infected again, then those cells will grow again. And they're starting this time from a much higher base, and they seem to reach their peak faster and a higher peak, and so we don't get as sick the second time we get measles. In fact, we may not get sick at all compared to the first time. And underlying this sort of overall response is the response of individual cell clones. So Alan discussed that the repertoire of cells, that is this, we talk about the diversity of the responses as being the repertoire. Let me just... So when we're naive, when we've never seen that particular virus, we have a very diverse repertoire that's not particularly biased towards that virus or anything else. But when the virus comes along, the antigen which can generate an immune response, then the cells that are most complementary, that bind most tightly, and here I guess we're looking at color complementarity, will grow, and we'd say the highest affinity clones, the ones that recognize it best, will grow most, and then there'll be some other low affinity clones which, you know, further away in shape space. So this is the one which would be very close in that shape space. And it turns out it's slightly more complex than that. With everything in immunology, there's always the caveat it's slightly more complex, and that is that you don't just respond to the virus as a whole. Particularly T cells respond to very, very small parts of the virus. So the virus, even the smallest human pathogen, which is hepatitis B virus, encodes thousands of amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. And T cells only recognize them in blocks of 10, roughly. And so you will get a whole group of cells that might be responding to one particular little block, which is called an epitope, and then a whole lot of other cells which are responding to another part of the virus. And so overall, we have responses to epitopes, and these tend to be of different sizes. So we might have response to one epitope which is dominant, and so 60% of the response might be targeted to this particular part of the virus, and then we might have a subdominant epitope where there is, you know, 20%, and we'll have a gradation and some very minor ones which we may not even be able to detect recognition of. And within this recognition of a dominant epitope, we'll also have a dominant clone often. There'll be a single cell which might be a large proportion of that response. And so trying to understand dominant epitopes and dominant clones is what I'll be talking about today. And this evolves over the course of an immune response because it won't necessarily be the same in the primary response, the first time we see a virus, and in the secondary response, which is, you know, when you get reinfected by flu or by measles a few years later. And it also might evolve quite differently under chronic infection, and that's, for example, the situation in HIV, where the virus persists. In flu, we get infected, we make a response, it goes away, and then we have no virus for a long period before it comes back, whereas in flu we have chronic infection. And in particular, we're interested in how we might manipulate this, and whether, if we could determine an optimal response, how could we actually generate it? So in terms of immunodominance, which is the question of why does one region of a virus, one epitope, dominate over another? And people have looked at this experimentally, immunologists have looked at it, to try and answer this question. And one reason might just be that we produce more of, the virus produces more of that particular protein, or even there's another level of complexity, which is you not only have to produce more of the protein, but it might be that it's easier to chop up that protein into that particular shape. And so it might just, but it might just be the overall level of production. And there's some evidence for this in look in a LCMV, which is a particular virus of mice, that people can take the cells which are infected and basically add acid and release the peptides of the virus and find that the amount of peptide, the amount of this small epitope on the surface of the cell is related to the amount of response. And people have also looked at this in HIV. So it may be that the amount of the epitope that actually gets onto the cell is determining why you get a better response to some than others, some regions. Well, now that's an interesting question, because other people have said that it might be that this shape space is not flat and that you're much better able to recognize a particular region. But then you might expect that to vary between individuals, because your repertoire of cells is different from mine, so that if it was all on the basis that cells were either close or far from a particular shape, given that we don't fill shape space evenly, you might respond better. But that doesn't seem to be the case within inbred mice, that they always seem to have the same dominant epitope. If you've got identical, genetically identical mice, they'll have different repertoires, but they still always respond to the same epitope as being dominant. Well, that's I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that the level of production and presentation. So production might be the number of copies the virus makes. So for HIV, the coat protein, it makes a lot of copies of that because that's actually structural, making up the virus. But there's other proteins inside it which it only makes a few copies of because they're enzymes. So that's the level of production of the virus. But the level of presentation to T cells is actually more complex, because T cells don't recognize the free virus. They recognize the virus once it's been chopped up and put on the surface of another cell, the antigen-presenting cell or the infected cell itself. But I won't go into the details of that. That's another story in itself of how they get there. But it's probably related to both of these. And the experiments that I described, where you take cells and that are infected and you add acid and release the peptides, they're actually looking at what's on the surface of the cell able to be recognized rather than the amount of viral protein. There's also some recent evidence that the epitope may be presented on more stimulatory cells, because not all cells stimulate T cells equally. In particular, there are these dendritic cells, which are thought to be very important at initiating a response. And there's been an example in influenza where one part of the virus is present on dendritic cells and on all infected cells, and another part only seems to be on dendritic cells. And it could be that T cells get more or less stimulation because of this presentation. It could be that it's presented earlier in infection, and people, for example, would talk about this with HIV, that some proteins might be copied very early in infection and others very late in infection of a cell, and therefore the one that were stimulated cells earlier might win the race, as it were, because it got a head start. And there's examples also in something like Epstein-Barr virus, which causes glandular fever, where the virus actually expresses different proteins when it first infects you to a month later. It changes from lytic proteins, which burst the cell and make more virus, to latent proteins, where it actually infects the cell and stays resting without releasing new viral particles. But the idea that it might be stochastic, related to the affinity of cells and how they fit shape space, I don't think really fits with the question of immunodominance, because it's always the same parts of the virus are dominant regardless of where you of the different repertoires in individual animals. The question of clonal dominance is now, once we've got a response to a particular part of the virus, you know, why does this clone make many more cells than this one or that one? And the obvious answer is that it might be the highest affinity T cell clone, the one that recognizes the virus best, that's closest to it in shape space, might have a growth advantage. So, you know, this cell here being closest obviously has advantages over the others, might get more stimulation. And there's been, Rob DeBoer had a paper a couple of years ago suggesting that there's a higher growth rate for cells recognizing a dominant epitope as opposed to a subdominant epitope, for example. So it may be that that level of stimulation affects the growth rate. It could again be to do with the timing that cells, that a particular clone happens to be in the right place at the right time, and it sees the peptide and takes off, and other cells, because they arrive later, just can't compete. And then we would expect that there to be a stochastic element there. And you could also imagine that timing could be related. Timing and affinity might be related, because when you're infected with a virus and the amount of virus is going up and up, if this is a threshold at which a particular T cell is able to respond to the virus, if one T cell is able to respond to 1,000 copies and the other one 10,000, clearly the one that responds to 1,000 will be stimulated earlier in infection, as well as potentially growing faster once it is stimulated. So the timing could be important. It could simply be stochastic. And this gets back to the idea that there's a small number of precursors, maybe of the order of 10 cells of any particular clone in the body before you're infected. And so the timing might be related to whether that particular cell happens to be in the right anatomical compartment, in the lymph node, for example. And because of this small number of precursors, it could become quite important. And there's evidence for that as well. Precursor number is, in most cases, I don't think is important, although some people would differ, because the shape space tends to be, I think, fairly evenly populated and fairly flat. But there are some very notable exceptions to that. And whereas in the general response, if you respond to one part of, we're responding to the same part of the virus, I'll use a completely different T cell receptor to you, because we've got different clones filling that shape space near the virus. And they'll be completely unrelated, although they'll probably be making a similar response. But there are also some viruses, some parts of viruses, where there seem to be what we call public specificities. And that is that we actually use the same T cell receptor. Everybody uses the same T cell receptor to respond to this particular part of the virus. It's not true that everybody does, but everyone that's reasonably closely related, at least all identical mice would, use the same T cell receptor. And that seems to be an example of where the shape space is not flat, and around this particular part of the virus, for example, there may only be one clone which can sit there, or a family of extremely closely related clones. We don't quite understand why that is, but certainly in some circumstances that seems to be important, but those circumstances are fairly rare. And there might also be strange specific effects. And there's been a recent paper looking at the structure of the T cell receptor to suggest that some peptides, some parts of the virus might interact differently with the T cell receptor, and that if you can cause, for example, a conformational change in the T cell receptor, you might stimulate much better. So it may be that affinity is not the only issue. There's a sort of super affinity interaction that occurs on the basis of different structural changes, but we don't really understand very much about that. So all of that was to do with how we decide which cell is going to respond best in the primary, and how we'll fill that, the shape space of the response around the virus in the primary response when you first get infected. Now, that's only part of the story. The primary response was to come from a naive repertoire with lots of different random shapes to select out what we might call the primary effectors. These are the cells that are going to go and kill the virus. They're effector cells. And we'll have different clones dominating to different extents. And then we'll form a memory pool, and that's when the number of cells goes up and then it comes down, and we retain this small number for life. And in general, the memory pool seems to be a fairly close reflection of the primary. And then if we get infected again, these cells will grow out again to respond to the next influenza infection. And we might call these memory effectors. Again, they're subserving the function of killing the virus, but they grew from the memory repertoire. So they already had a head start because they were much more highly represented in the resting pool. So the primary effectors we just talked about, the formation of memory, as I said, it appears to be a good reflection of the frequency in primary. So the ratio of clones to each other in the primary is maintained in the secondary, although the overall response goes right down. And that seems quite consistent with the idea of stochastic transition from the primary response to the memory, that a fixed proportion goes through. There's just a random sampling. However, memory may be unstable when there's persisting virus, persisting antigen, persisting stimulation. And there's some examples of that, that in fact the total number of memory cells may go up over time, or the responses to different parts of the virus may change with time as well. That you may respond to one part of the virus early on, and then a year later you'll be responding mainly to another part. Now, the memory effector pool is when we get infected the second time and now those memory cells are growing out. So we had the primary effectors, we made this resting memory pool, which was a good reflection of the primary, and we thought there was just stochastic transition. Now we're infecting again and we're having these memory effectors growing out to kill the flu cells, the flu-infected cells the second time around. And there's a number of possibilities of what it could be. Again, we don't really have a good picture. The experimental evidence is variable. Some people say it's similar to primary, and it is in a sort of general form, but it also appears to be more focused. That is, that if we were filling a certain diameter of shape space fairly evenly, now we're becoming much more focused on the high affinity cells that are very close to the correct shape. And so we have enhanced immunodominance or clonal dominance within the secondary response. It could be randomly different, that actually affinity didn't mean anything and was just luck that particular cells grew out. And there is some evidence for that as well, that actually some people have suggested that there's randomness in the primary but it's lost in the secondary, and that's the reason for the difference. There could be a different pattern, so for some reason your distance from your distance in shape space is less important, or there's a different function of that distance to stimulation in the memory response, and that might be because of what's going on in terms of the level of antigen that's present. And in persisting stimulation, cells might not respond the same way over time, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. So this, I think, the generation of the memory effector pool and what's happening there, I see, is particularly important because this relates to vaccination. This is really what's happening when we vaccinate someone. We immunize them, we give you the injection of the killed virus, for example, you make a primary response. But what we're really interested in is when you get infected the second time, the memory response, what is the characteristic of that? Can we have a response which is most able to kill the virus? So that's why we're particularly interested in this memory effector pool. And so what determines this? And again, it's likely to be the same things that determine the primary, the affinity, the timing, is it stochastic, does the precursor frequency make a difference? And this is the question we've been trying to address. And I'll talk about two modeling approaches. One, looking at Epstein-Barr virus, which is the virus that causes glandular fever, which causes chronic infection, and just a deterministic model of that. And another, a stochastic stage structured model, which is a more elaborate model to try and address these questions. So in the model of chronic infection with Epstein-Barr virus, the data The experimental data that we were looking at to try and model was data from humans with blood taken in acute infection and then 1 year later. This is a chronic infection, so once you're infected, you never get rid of this virus, and so there's persisting virus at a low level still stimulating T cells. And 11 patients, and I guess from the point of view of the, I'll ignore that for the point of view of the physicists in the audience, but the amazing thing in this particular infection is that you respond, remember, to a particular part of the virus, and here we're able to detect cells responding to a particular part of the virus, which is a particular epitope in the first three letters of its amino acid code, RAK, and you can see 28% of cells respond to this part of the virus, and 57% of the cells that respond to this part of the virus also use a particular V beta. Now, remember that Alan talked about the mixing and matching of different regions of the genes to make this combinatorial system, and this is a particular part of that which only a small proportion, maybe 10% of the overall, or in fact here you can see 18% of the general population of T cells use this, 57% responding to this part of the virus.
Is it, did you say 20% of all T cells are specific, or of the virus specific
one? So this is an acute infection of all CD8 cells.
So this is at the peak of the acute infection?
This is at the peak of the, well, we don't, well, it hasn't been done over time, but it's acute infection. Yeah.
Okay, so given
right, so this work was all done in collaboration with Margaret Callan and Andrew McMichael at the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Oxford, and so that, they've looked at it over, and it's quite amazing. This is a particular example of a very, this is the strongest response to an epitope of a particularly, a virus that caused a particularly strong response. So it's unusual, but what's even more unusual is that when Margaret Callan sequenced the T cell receptor, so now we're looking at the actual gene sequence of the T cell receptor, and we think that if the sequences are identical, they must have come from the same original T cell clone, because the chances of two identical T cell receptors coming about just by chance is so incredibly low because there's so many possibilities. And when she sequenced the clones, Margaret Callan found that 7 out of 10 clones use the same T cell receptor. And if you multiply all those numbers together, you find that 11% of the total CD8 T cells are from a single clone. So we've gone from a frequency of individual clones of something like 10 to the minus, 1 in 10 to the 7, to being, you know, 1 in 10. So there's been a massive expansion of particular clones recognizing a particular part of the virus.
So, and this is all in many different individuals, or just for a single infected individual?
This is a single infected individual that she studied here, but there are, this order of magnitude of expansion she's seen in a number of different individuals.
What's the
antigen synthetic? The RAK, so this is a B8, I think, it's either A2 or B8 restricted response. And it tends to be the dominant epitope in people that have the right HLA type. I'm pretty sure it's B8. It's dominant. That's not the numbers aren't always going to work out to exactly 11%, but it tends to be pretty high. It's certainly of that order. So 11%. So there's been massive expansion of this particular response.
And then different individuals with the same HLA type, do you find the clones from the same individual?
Yes. So the other, what I referred to before about the special, the special features of the response is actually referring to this particular response that now the crystals, a group in Melbourne, Kjell Nielsen and colleagues have made the crystal structure, and it seems to be there's actually a change in the shape of the T cell receptor, and they think that's responsible for this apparent public specificity of the response. But we didn't know that at the time.
So this relates with the introduction of Alan has been giving that the potential of these repertoires is much larger than the real repertoire. So if we all carry different T cells, then you would not expect the different individuals infected with the same virus.
Okay, so I didn't say they had identical T cell receptors. They use the same V beta, which is not the same as having identical T cell receptors. They're very similar, but they're not identical. So I guess that depends the extent to which, for example, the binding is determined by the V beta as opposed to the hypervariable region, the CDR3 region, for example, where there really is randomness and it's not selecting. So. Right, sorry, yeah, these people are chosen because they have an MHC type that's all matching. So this only, it's even more complex than that because it only exists in people who are HLA-B8, and I hope I've got it right there, this particular public specificity, and if they have the right, if they have another HLA allele, they then lose this response because presumably it's been deleted. So it's a fairly complicated picture. But not wanting to go into that, just to say that we were interested in looking, these people had blood taken at acute infection and a year later, and we were interested in looking at how the response evolves. And if it was purely stochastic entry into the memory population, then we would expect that the memory population should just look a lot like the primary population. So the ratio, we might expect that if this is the percent change of the proportion of cells responding in the primary to the secondary. And we would suggest that if it was just stochastic, then since the overall numbers go down, we might just see, you know, 50% of cells, if it was half, for example, would of the number that was in the primary would be seen in the secondary. So they would all change 50%. But instead what we see is that if we look at the number of cells in the primary, cells that the clones that expanded a lot in the primary, or in this case, responses to epitopes that expanded a lot in the primary went down more in the secondary, and ones that didn't expand very much in the primary actually went up in the secondary. So there's been quite a change. The cells that expanded most seem to contract most, and the ones that expanded least. And that was at the level of responses to different parts of the virus, and now this is at the level of individual T cell clones. So this is looking at the T cell using the V betas to identify the T cells.
It means during the persistent phase, not after a secondary response.
Persistent phase, because yeah, this is a year later, there's no secondary challenge, it's just the persistent phase. And again, we see that the cells that expanded most have gone down in number, and those that have not expanded much at all have often gone up. So there seems to be this slight inversion of the response from one both from one part of the virus to another, and by dominance of individual clones to dominance of other clones over time. And so why do the greatly expanded cells decrease relatively more was the question that we wanted to address. The total number definitely goes down overall. That's why we're looking at they're all down, and we're just looking at the proportion representation, whether they all went down equally or some went down a lot more.
Right,
so,
right. But what I'm asking is, if you have, you know, a huge number of a particular kind, and just a few of another that responded to another signal, you might want to not save too many of the ones that get a huge number of copies.
Right. Yes, so there's usually in most responses there's sort of a fixed proportion go into memory, but we really don't know whether that, as you say, whether we tend to flatten it or whether we tend to enhance it. Because another, you could equally well argue, well, the immune response might want to enhance the response of those that were most closely related, so it should boost those. And there's evidence for that as well. So depending on the type of response you look at, sometimes you see an immune focusing, and here we seem to see a shift away from the most focused response.
But I think the question is a simple one of replotting the population rather than the percent change.
Right, so this is the cell, here I've got it.
That's what's in the internet.
Yeah, this is the cell number in primary, and here I've put percent in memory, but I may as well have put cell number because it's just multiply it by the total population. And here you can see that if it was stochastic and they were it was a fixed fraction, then we should expect this line to be straight, but instead we have it going down in the where you've got more cells, that we tend to curve off and flatten out. Sorry, I should have probably represented it that way. I thought it was clearer this way, the percent change, but yes, that's how we did the statistics to show that it was significantly decreased. It wasn't just stochastic.
And even the data for later time, so now you've got, this is 1 year after the infection, so you expect it, because it's changing with time, unlike after an acute infection, so at a later point in time, say 2 years after infection, you expect it to be even more accentuated.
I haven't looked at that, but it may be, but I suspect it will be changing more slowly in chronic infection than it does in acute, because cells are turning over much more slowly. So we just made a simple model of CTL, which are killer T cells, either cells that go out and kill the virus, proliferation. And so we can think of our naive repertoire, and then if cells are stimulated because they're closely related to the, they have a good match with the virus, then they can become effectors and they can divide and make more effectors and they can kill the virus. And then they can differentiate into memory, and we have this occurring stochastically. And then when they're stimulated, they can go to, back to be effectors. And the memory cells can also divide at some low rate and both can die. And we can also, and just using simple ordinary differential equations to look at the number of naive cells, effector cells, and memory cells over time. We assume that the activation of naive cells, the proliferation of effectors, and the activation of memory cells are all related to the level of antigen stimulation. So, and the level of antigen stimulation is not just the total amount of antigen, it's also related to how closely, how high an affinity you have for it, whether you're very close to it in shape space. And death is related to 1 minus the level of stimulation. And we use a saturating function, a Hill function for the level of stimulation. So there's amount of virus Y, and each viral particle produces E number of epitopes. Then we can imagine that there might be a dissociation constant, which here I've got A for affinity, and Alan keeps correcting me, I should call it dissociation constant, binding constant, that will determine, this will be unique for that clone, and the overall stimulation will be related to the amount of virus, how many viral particles, and this is really how close in shape space you are to that particular part of the virus. And for viral proliferation, we just make a fairly traditional model where you have uninfected cells that bind to virus, become infected. In this case, they can also become latently infected, which means they're just resting and not producing any virus. And I'll sort of skip the equations for that. But the bottom line is that if we make a simple model of chronic infection like that, and we just assume that proliferation is always proportional to the number of cells, to the number of epitopes and how high the affinity is, then we find that a single clone dominates very quickly. And this has been described before as competitive exclusion. And this has parallels in the ecological setting, that this clone responds best, it expands most, it drives the level of virus down so low that the other clones with lower affinity can't even see the virus, and then it just takes up 100% of the response. But this is not what we see happen, because we see this changeover of responses. Rather, this would be an immune focusing by the best responder, but instead we see a switch. So other explanations could be exhaustion, and that is that the T cells just run out of steam at a certain point. And so the ones that are stimulated most get tired and can't keep going on. And this is also senescence, aging of the cells. And that's been described experimentally. And Rustam and colleagues have also looked at a model of that some years ago. And so we thought, well, what if we put senescence into the whole equation? What do we get? Well, what we need to do now is keep track of the number of times the cells divided, because we think that the more times it divides, the more likely it is to senesce. So this is basically what we saw before, but now cells, in order to divide, need to move into the next division category, and they've got a little subscript for the number of divisions they can do. And now, instead of stimulation only being related to the amount of antigen and how high the affinity is, it's also related to the number of divisions. So again, we can have a Hill function and have some number of divisions at which the level of stimulation is reduced by 50%. So this is like when you get old, you just don't see the virus as well as you did earlier. And so cells can early on, this will be very small, and this will be one, and as the cells senesce, then this gets smaller and smaller, they get stimulated less and less until they die off. And when we do that, and on the right is the model simulation, we get a very similar pattern to what we saw in the experimental data, and that is the cells that proliferate most tend to go down in number, and the cells that proliferate least go up. And so we thought that this senescence was a good explanation of this changeover, this inversion, and the apparent preferential death of very high affinity clones. And when we looked at the model and what was actually happening, what we saw, we termed clonal succession. And that is that you get initially this dashed line is the early virus, and then we have very, very low level of virus persisting for 350 days of the simulation. And the highest affinity clone grows out very well early on, but then tends to die off because it's used up all of its cell divisions and it now senesces. And another clone takes over, and then another clone, and then another clone, and another clone. And interestingly, these clones are lower and lower affinity. These bumps here. I think those bumps are probably, you would see an equivalent on the virus, that the virus is actually reaching some equilibrium level with the cells. An ODE model. No stochastic component at all. Yep.
How many cell divisions are there then, approximately?
Well, it's hard to know in lymphocytes, but the Hayflick limit, as it was originally described, was thought to be about 60 cell divisions. But there's a whole number of reasons why that might be wrong. But there's a mechanism. The ends of the chromosomes get chopped off every time a cell divides. And when they get too short, then the cell dies, essentially. And so that provides some limit. But actually, that limit seems to be much higher than what's actually observed, how often cells can divide. So it's not entirely clear. But there's a lot of evidence for senescence in vitro.
So why did you put your effect senescence in stimulation, not death?
Sorry?
You use senescence to reduce stimulation.
Right.
Why did you do that instead of making senescence increase the death?
Oh, it does indirectly, because death is 1 minus the level of stimulation. So both things happen. You're less able to proliferate and you're more prone to die. So you're right, I guess I could have just had it independently be a death function and not affect stimulation. I guess I see it affecting stimulation because it affects your ability to divide, as I assume, as well as your likelihood of death. But it could be that it only affects you. We don't really have much of a handle on that experimentally, I think.
Max, does this give you a way to distinguish between the immune response for a chronic infection as opposed to a secondary response to a secondary infection? Because now you don't have a resting population of viruses, so the first clone that shot up in the first primary response doesn't really have to go on dividing, and there's nothing.
Right. So we would think that in an acute response, if you just get immunized and then infected, you probably won't ever reach the number of cell divisions you need to see senescence. And it's probably most likely either in a response where you've been immunized many, many times, or in this chronic response where you're being stimulated all the time, and so there's division.
So I like to see that there's actually an example of senescence during actual infection. So you've made a testable prediction that your cells are sort of the crops which aren't proliferating that much, are shorter telomeres than the ones which
No, well, I don't speculate on the mechanism, but I make a prediction that the ones later on are lower affinity, and that we could test using tetramers, but unfortunately, because there's so few data points, because we only had...
But why not make the telomere argument? Because the problem is that for lots of the senescence, the only possible, the plausible mechanism telomeres don't seem to work with lots of immune cells, because when they divide, there were lots of papers that showed they upregulate telomerase and they grow back their telomeres.
Right, so HIV is the case where you see the telomere shortening, and in other infections it's pretty difficult to find it. But I don't know that that's the only mechanism of senescence. Certainly in general infections it's hard to see shortened telomeres. I'm not aware of an example of that, but yeah, I'll take your, yeah. So, but telomeres are not the only mechanism, I think, of senescence. So the problems with this model was that it was deterministic, that the affinity was just arbitrarily chosen as an amount of virus that caused 50% stimulation. And as Rob de Boer pointed out to me, the proliferation is very unrealistic because using these ODEs, there's a possibility that, you know, a cell can make it through to, you know, 20 divisions in a time that's much shorter than we think. You know, if there's a minimum of 6 hours, then you can't get to 20 divisions in less than 100. But in principle, with using these ODEs, you can. And so we've moved on to a stochastic age-structured model of the response. And so in this case, we consider the progeny of an individual clone. The life cycle is divided into stages, naive cell, stimulated naive cell, proliferating effector cell, etc. We need only to keep track of the number of cells of this clone in each stage rather than each individual cell. We use discrete time steps, and transitions between these stages are stochastic. And so this stage-structured model lies somewhere between the sort of traditional ODE model and an individual-based model. And the reason why we haven't used an individual-based model is that it's so computationally expensive when we're looking at millions or hundreds of millions of cells. So, whereas this, for a given cell clone, we have a fixed number of stages that the cells could be in. And so the general behaviours, again, are to have virus infecting target cells, and then naive cells get stimulated by antigen and get ready to proliferate, take some fixed time to proliferate, and once they do, they become effector cells. Effector cells can then proliferate very rapidly, and they also kill the infected cells, and so there's a negative feedback loop. They wipe out the cells, and eventually these proliferating effector cells die and form memory cells. And then, as we said, memory cells can become stimulated. And proliferation is to create this minimum time for proliferation, we use a Smith-Martin model where we've got a number of stages. Once a cell enters proliferation, it must go through a fixed number of stages, in this case 5 hours, before it re-enters the pool, where then it has stochastic entry. It has a delay while it waits for stochastic entry again into this fixed number of divisions. So, and these are 1 hour blocks, and so it can wait an hour or more depending on the proliferation rate. So, importantly, at around the time we were developing the model, this idea of antigen-independent proliferation came out and became very popular. And I call this proliferative momentum, and that's the idea that once a cell gets stimulated, it can't stop dividing for a fixed number of divisions. Once it's stimulated, it just keeps on going. It doesn't need any more stimulation. So there is experimental evidence that if you stimulate for as short as a couple of hours, it'll keep dividing for up to 8 cell divisions. And again, Rustam's very recently published a model of that in JTB. And so we've included that in the model. The precursor number is quite important. Since all, using proliferative momentum, all cells are going to divide for a fixed time, so they're all going to go create, you know, one cell's going to create a million cells, for example. So the number of cells that enter division becomes important to create the overall number that will be seen at the end of the response. The number that are recruited becomes very important. I think we just saw that. And so the stochastic implementation is to try and decide how many naive cells become stimulated, etc. And to do that, we simply look at the probability of a certain what proportion of the cells will divide in a certain time based on a binomial distribution. So we have a number of cells, we have a rate of division, and the probability of an event occurring at a given time is given by an exponential distribution, and then the probability occurring over the time from zero to the time step, delta t, we can calculate. And then drawing from a binomial distribution, we get the number of cells that divide in that time step. So we start with 10 cells, and for a certain level of stimulation, we draw a random number and see how many cells divide. So that's the implementation of the stochastic part of the model. And we can use a time step varying from 10 minutes to an hour. The naive clone size is very small. It's only 10 cells, which appears to be similar to what's seen in a mouse. And then T cells get recruited from the naive cells in, from the naive cells into the effector cells. And there's a delay once they are recruited. And then once they memory cells are activated much more rapidly, it only takes an hour for them to become effector cells. And CTL have a death rate, and the time in the B phase is 5 hours, and the average CTL cycle time is 6 hours. So cells can divide very rapidly once they're...
Question. These are the parameters that go into the model.
Right.
And you're arguing that you have taken them from whatever information is available.
Right, from the experimental literature, where it's available. It's not available for everything, and particularly for the viral dynamics.
And
which
once you show us how well the model works, you're going to argue that it's not sensitive, or the places where it's sensitive, you know. I mean, well, maybe I should ask the question more than you.
Sure, we can come back to the question.
Are all the numbers taken from experiments of mice? Or
yes. Yes, I think these are all from mice. Uh-huh. Yeah. But we're more interested in the qualitative outcome of the response and understanding the clonal dynamics and what's happening. So we again have a very similar equations for virus to what I showed you the first time around, but no latent compartment. And I just put this in at the last minute because I heard some people talking about string matching. In fact, in the model, the affinity is decided by a string matching between a nominal T-cell receptor and a nominal viral particle bound to these MHC molecules, which are the molecules on the surface of the infected cell which hold the bit of virus for the T-cell receptor to see. But I won't dwell on that, just to say that's we have incorporated that in the model to get an idea of affinity, but we haven't really used that specificity concept very much at this stage. And so here we've got in the dashed line, for example, we can infect an animal and the amount of virus goes up quite high, drops down when the T cells start to kill off the virus, and the number of responding cells goes up, reaches a peak and then declines. And if because we have this idea of proliferative momentum, if we terminate the infection early on, we still see a very similar outcome in terms of the total number of responding cells, because once they're stimulated to divide, they just carry through this program. And so this, for example, is an example of a simulation, and all these colors represent different clones. The amount of virus goes up initially. The high affinity clones will have a tendency to respond first, but not this won't be absolute because of the stochastic nature of it. We may have a mix of high affinity and low affinity clones early on, and then later on predominantly there'll be low affinity clones because all of the high affinity clones will already be recruited into the response, and then the number of cells decays to form the memory pool. And when we challenge with virus a second time, in this case virus doesn't get to grow for very long because the T cells are able to respond and kill it off, but the number of T cells goes up as we might expect because of the further stimulation and proliferation. So just an example of the sort of question we might want to address with this, this is a very recent paper from Journal of Immunology where they were comparing killed bacteria with live bacteria in terms of their ability to cause an immune response. And this is important in this context because those are two different ways that we might administer a vaccine, for example. And they suggested that killed microorganisms are inefficient at inducing clonal expansion because they didn't see as much proliferation. And they looked at day five predominantly, and they saw that in the case of, this is the total number of tetramer-positive cells, which are cells responding to a particular type, part of the bacteria. And when you use a live virus, it's going up at 5 days, and a killed, it's going down, and they're very similar at the beginning. And the same, whether you look in lung or in spleen, you see the same thing. And I think this is important in terms of the antigen kinetics. Because when you give a virus, the amount of virus goes up slowly or rapidly, and then goes down. But when you give a killed vaccine, you give a large dose early on and then it just decays, presumably, we assume exponentially or some relatively simple function of decay. So if stimulation of the T cells is a saturating function of antigens, then the proportion, then it's proportional to the number of infected cells times the number of epitopes per cell, and this dissociation constant is the peptide density for half maximal stimulation, so that we could imagine here there's some density of virus that causes half maximal stimulation of a particular clone. So doesn't see the virus up until this point, and suddenly it does and it starts to proliferate. And that might be the highest affinity clone, and then we might have a lower affinity clone that only sees virus when it gets to this point, and then it begins to proliferate. And so there would be, in a purely deterministic model, there would be an absolute time advantage here. But in the stochastic model, because the virus is growing very quickly, these time points may be relatively close together. But in any event, in a growing virus, we end up with a slight advantage to a cell that's stimulated early on, to a high affinity cell. And the delay will be, you know, proportional to, inversely proportional to the growth rate. Whereas with a killed virus, a killed bacteria in this case, we start with a very high level, and everything that has its threshold under this level will be stimulated on day one in parallel. There will be no delay between high and low affinity. They'll both start off at the same time. No delay in the initiation. And importantly, the antigen kinetics on the downside may also turn out to be important, because if this is sort of the amount of proliferation they do without further stimulation, you can imagine that this cell that's low affinity, by the time it finishes its programmed response, now the viral level has dropped below, or the, in this case the killed bacterial level has dropped below what it sees, so now it just dies off and doesn't get any more stimulation. Whereas the higher affinity response, by the time it finishes its programmed response, there's the viral level, this bright green line, is still well above its level of stimulation. So it continues to proliferate for another time period until the viral level drops below. So there can be a differentiation in the magnitude of the response between high affinity and low affinity responses, both on the upslope, when you've got a growing virus, by the difference in time between when it crosses these thresholds, and on the downslope. The downslope will be common to both live and killed bacteria, but with killed bacteria, you'll only get a differentiation on the downslope, not on the upslope.
Miles, in some vaccinations, you have more than, I mean, you get a series of shots. I don't know if they get virus or not, but with that, how would that affect your... So if you came back and revaccinated at some point?
So, well, that's what we're very interested in looking at, and it seems, can I get onto that? Because, so the downslope may also split, but not necessarily. So with non-replicating, you see the downslope effects as well. Now, it's a stochastic model, so because of the small initial number of cells, which is only 10, there's a tendency for the high affinity responses to be stimulated first, but not necessarily, and there can be quite a lot of overlap and randomness in the response. So here we've got these circles are the amount of virus, these white triangles here are the total number of responding cells, and here are in responses to individual clones. And I've ignored this because this is the answer to your question. This is the second infection, and we'll come back to that. And you can see that individual clones start growing at different times, but it's not necessarily the highest affinity clone that grows very early on. But by this stage here, for example, we've got a whole mix of low affinity clones because we've had a very high viral load. So if we look at the amount of virus required for 50% maximal stimulation, in the overall population we had a very high amount of virus, and early in the acute infection this drops down quite low. So now we've had early in the response a selection for very high affinity clones, but surprisingly it jumps back up pretty soon after. And that's because although these cells had the early growth advantage, now there were a much larger number of cells slightly more antigenically distant in shape space, and now those cells have divided and they're making the average affinity worse. So a tendency to the, for the primary pool to be a mix of high and low affinity. What about a memory response? And the major difference here is that we have a very large initial number of cells. So this stochastic element of early stimulation is essentially lost. But we still have the tendency for high affinity clones to be stimulated first. And so what we see here is that only the high affinity clones grow out because the amount of virus is controlled much earlier and because the stochastic element is lost. So we see a maturation of the response. And in terms of the paradigms I described earlier on, is it stochastic, is it due to affinity, is it due to timing, it's actually due to all of those things.
Is senescence important for this?
No, there's no senescence in this model. No senescence in this model yet.
I see that you don't have competitive exclusion anymore during the memory phase. So maybe all these lines are horizontal. So what did you change in the model? Are they no longer...
The initial model was one of persistent infection, and this is acute infection. Right, right. Yep. So I should have pointed that out, that this is different in that. So we've.
There's also no explicit competition for
antigen. Yeah, there's no competition for antigen 2. So it's only being driven by the amount of antigen and the level of stimulation. And similarly, if we look at the average affinity, we can see it gets much, it's very much improved in the secondary response, and that that improvement's carried through into the memory pool that's generated after the secondary response. So in answer to your question about revaccination, it's selecting for a much higher affinity group of cells, and you're losing the stochastic element. Non-replicating antigen, now we have the situation where we give a very high dose and it declines with time, and now there's no differentiation between high and low affinity clones. All the clones with an affinity above a certain level will be stimulated from day one because we didn't have to wait for it to rise through those phases and preferentially stimulate other cells. And if we give a lower dose, then we only stimulate higher affinity clones. And here is a secondary challenge. And when we give the secondary challenge now, as the amount of virus rises up, we don't have that stochastic element early on because we've now got a large population of cells. So in terms of what the experimental results suggesting that we had the same number of cells on day 5, but the live response was somehow qualitatively different because it was going up, this looks very similar to what we see in the model, that if we look at the peak of the response, the peak is later in when we give live virus, and higher and lower and earlier. So the peak is about 10 days if we give a live virus, about 6 days with killed, and we've got about two orders of magnitude difference in the response. But the number at day 5 is actually very similar between the two. And this looks very much like what we see here, is that the number of day 5 is the same, and yet the number continues to go up. So that there's no, you don't need to invoke any qualitative difference in the response here. It's just due to the antigen kinetics that some cells reach their peak, that with killed virus they reach their peak early on and decline. So there's also evidence that the affinity is inversely proportional to the antigen load, which is what we saw with the high and low dose killed antigen. So in terms of why one clone dominates over another, we started thinking it could be the highest affinity, could be due to timing, could be stochastic, could be due to precursor number or specific effects. We haven't really addressed these questions, but certainly all of these seem to be able to go together, that affinity is related to the timing of activation, and with a small cell number, the stochastic part of the response is also important, that the secondary response is much more predictable because we don't have the small number of starting cells. And the memory effector pool is more focused, randomly different, but really that randomness was in the primary response. And we haven't really looked at the idea of a different pattern in terms of senescence. But what's determining this can just be the affinity, the timing, the stochastic nature of the recruitment, and we haven't really addressed precursor frequency. So I'd just like to thank those who've worked on the model, and that's Alan Perelson, also Dennis Chow and Stephanie Forrest from University of New Mexico. And I should also say Margaret Callan and Andrew McMichael, who provided the experimental data on the Epstein-Barr virus infection. So I'll leave that there if anyone has any questions. Dan. Experimentally. Yeah, partly because it's very difficult to measure. It also, as with all things in immunology, it turns out to be much more complex because you can measure the affinity of the T cell receptor, but that's not the only determinant of the functional affinity. So if you take a transgenic mouse that has all of its T cell receptors identical, you can still find a spectrum of antigen concentrations over which the cells will respond, presumably because of differences in other co-receptors or in signaling. So it's not as simple as T cell receptor alone, but certainly...
But should I think of affinity in your model as really being...
No, I think functional avidity is the term that people tend to use when they're referring to the T cell receptor, the co-receptor molecules, the signaling, the works. Right, right. So you could just, I was trying to emphasize, think about it in terms of the concentration of virus at which you get 50% stimulation, for example, and that will vary with different clones. But the model was initially developed and with the idea of string matching between antigen and T-cell receptor, and the affinity being determined by the sort of closeness in antigenic distance. And I think what will be much more interesting to look at in the model is now to look at how that response evolves in shape space, as it were, if virus moves around, where the ideas of cross-reactivity and affinity and the importance of that.
Maybe a general question to the group related to this. You know, as we'll hear tomorrow, the rate constant, the rate of binding to the T cell receptor, and the off-rate constant, like an optimum residence time for those complexes. Has anyone developed a dynamic model where the rate constant of T cell MHC peptide interactions is important rather than the equivalent of affinity? Is that something that's going to do in the group?
You mean in the population?
Yeah, the population. Okay.
I mean, because ideally a model would try and incorporate those issues as well, but I guess there's little knowledge on what. That and that's a question we're very interested in looking at as well. This trade-off between the dose of antigen and the affinity of the response is an interesting one. So if I want to get a larger magnitude response, I just give you a whole lot more killed bacteria. But you'll end up with, on average, a lower affinity response. So what, maybe it's better to give you 10 very small doses over time, and because the magnitude builds up each time, I may end up with a higher response at the end of the day. On the other hand, if you start to incorporate the idea of senescence, then maybe I don't actually want to stimulate you 10 times, because then maybe the best responding cells will have, you know, be worn out by the end of that. So in terms of what people are using in humans to try and get an optimal response, people are having a preference to use live viruses as the final boost before they challenge. And perhaps live viruses might have the advantage because they have this growth phase of separating out and preferentially stimulating high affinity clones compared to the killed vaccines, which stimulate them all equally initially. But, you know, it's not really an issue that's been addressed. All of the vaccine work that's being done is completely empirical, and they're not really measuring affinity, they're just measuring the number of cells. So that's why we're interested to try and get a handle on what's going on in those dynamics. Well, you can take T cells from young and old people, for example, and stick them in vitro and they don't divide as many times. In terms of the level of apoptosis, it's difficult to measure in vivo, so there's limited experimental evidence for it in vivo. There's clearly something unusual going on that's causing this. Senescence seems an explanation that's consistent with, you know, the other data on aging of cells, etc. But, you know, I can't exclude there are other possible explanations. Competition, for example, between clones would also be one, but we don't have any evidence for that either, really. So.
Frederick, you know, in B cells in the germinal center reaction, you have all this proliferation, that the B cells de-differentiate, and they actually don't senesce anymore. They look pretty much like, almost like they're getting younger. They turn on telomerase and...
So Rustam mentioned, in fact, that telomerase is turned on, and there was a paper, in fact, in EBV came out just before, around the same time as this, that said that telomerase may be turned on in acute EBV. So it may be that during acute infections, telomerase is switched on and doesn't have a big role. And therefore, during that phase, it doesn't have as important a role in senescence as, for example, during chronic infection. If it's switched off again, maybe that sort of start cycling of repetitive stimulation is more active, more important then. Yes? Can I just say I don't really like proliferative momentum. I don't know that it exists. And the more data that comes out on it, the less real it looks, because in vivo there's less and less evidence.
I was just going to ask you about the effect it had on your results. Because I would have predicted that proliferative momentum, the more the difference between the stimulation event, then the harder it is to select.
Right. So with momentum, you make it more polyclonal. Yeah. No, I think that's probably right. Momentum is a vexed issue. It's been very misinterpreted because Rafi Ahmed's original data, for example, he showed that some T cells had undergone at least 8 cell divisions, and I've seen 2 or 3 subsequent papers that have quoted it and said all cells go through at least 8 cell divisions, whereas if you calculate the number of cells, it turns out to be, you know, much less than 1% actually could have possibly gone through 8 cell divisions in order to account for his profiles. So the majority of cells went through 1 or 2 cell divisions, and a few managed to go through 8, but very, very few of their progeny managed to survive in any event. And so more recent work in vivo has also shown that much longer stimulation times are required in vivo. So I think the jury's out. I mean, you may, Rustam, have more insight into...
So I think the phenomena is basically real, that if you stimulate cells and then watch how much they progress, but they can be absent of antigen, they continue to proliferate in the absence of antigen. And if you look at... But it's not a sort of strict program it's not a strict momentum, they don't all get the same amount of momentum. And Roth has shown that nicely by, if you plot the total per cell proliferation, it's not fixed.
Right.
Larger
and
infections give larger amounts of initial stimulation, give you more final numbers of divisions. So, but somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think as with most things, so once you cross this threshold and you've got enough stimulation, then you know there's probably some sort of distribution. It could be of some sort of intermediate signaling complex which gets diluted with cell divisions, and some cells have more and are able to go on longer, and if you get stimulated again, you refill your pool. There's different mechanisms that might be occurring there. There's also hysteresis, the idea that once you've got above a threshold, you now need much less of that signaling complex to keep you above the threshold. I'm not sure. I'm not. I think I made too many slides. No, not one of those. Maybe we should have a look later. I'm not sure what you mean, but it would be very interesting, and I'm sure that that's likely to be the case because of, for example, this idea of even with the same T cell receptor, there's a distribution of the level of stimulation.
You have argued that latency could be an explanation for this shift in dominance during. Senescence could be an explanation for this shift.
Right. Right.
And you also said that competition is an alternative.
Right.
And I think it would be very interesting to try to test which of the two is the most likely explanation.
Well,
and I think there is a prediction, as Russell was saying in your modeling, because if it's senescence, then the clones that win in the beginning are the first to go out. You can really replace some clones. Whereas if it's competition, then it's rather leveling out. The large clones and the small clones all of an equal size, but the initially small clones will not overtake the initially large ones.
So senescence is attractive because when you look at two sequential acute infections, you tend to get focusing, so the highest affinity clones are stimulated more and dominate more in the secondary infection. And so that if it was a strict competition, then you'd assume that those cells might see the same phenomenon. Whereas it's senescence, they've gone through more divisions. I guess you could equally well argue that if it's competition, it only cuts in at a certain threshold number of cells. So as long as you're below that threshold, then you don't see the competition. But I mean, we're interested to contrast the immune focusing that's seen with two sequential primary infections with this switch in dominance that's seen with a chronic infection. And senescence, and particularly because the example in which that switch has occurred is EBV, where things are so massively expanded that, I mean, I guess you can equally well argue that the massive expansion could have led to competition that just wasn't seen at lower levels. There's some explanation that has to differentiate chronic from acute infection. Can you distinguish? You can't distinguish between the two on the basis of affinity because both predict that the affinity should go down over time. Apoptosis rate, apoptosis rate doesn't tell you anything either. If you could look at the telomeres, for example, then you might make some prediction. But again, the average telomere length, if it's going to be shorter in cells that have divided more, it's going to be shorter because of senescence or because of dominance.
You just have to repeat the experiment that you're modeling. So they looked after a year of distribution. They knew the
right.
Distribution. You just have to do it after another year and after another year.
But how will that differentiate? Because in both you'd predict that it would still keep going down.
If it's senescent, then you lose the clones that were large in the beginning. So the lower infinity clones or the smaller clones will overtake the initially large clones. Whereas in competition, you would say that they all will kind of be approached to the same level.
And then remain constant? Well, I don't know, but Kleinemann has shown with the MCMV model that the number of memory cells goes up over time with persistent infection. So it's not a totally static situation with this chronic infection. There's this turnover of virus and turnover of T cells. And one explanation for why the number of cells goes up in the long term could be that, in fact, that the amount of virus and number of T cells is determined by some equilibrium between the affinity of T cells and the virus. And as the average affinity of T cells goes down as they senesce, the amount of virus goes up. That's a possible explanation, but I certainly don't think of chronic infection as a static situation where they'll just even out.
I think there's a difference. One is the replacement of clones, and the other is equaling out.
Yeah, I agree that I just think it's difficult to determine, well, did they even out then because they're now turning over so slowly that senescence is not important, or did they even out because they've come to a lower level, so competition? I think it can happen in both cases, but I'm not sure it differentiates the two. But I'd be very interested to talk about how to differentiate the two. I think it's a very interesting question. I guess you could, if it were a mouse, you could take the cells and stick them into a different environment, you know, take a third of the spleen and stick it into a new mouse, and if it's competition, then hopefully you've diluted it out, and if it's senescence, then you haven't changed it at all. That would be one.
Maybe we start with, we'll get some light.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Thank you.